hello again, everyone. Welcome to the last show of 2013 here on the Arts Magazine program, right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host, happily serving you. March 1st, it'll be my 25th year on this radio station, 26 for the radio station, 26 glorious years here for KKFI, your community radio station, serving the community, we hope, in many, many positive ways. And this last show of the new year, I wanted to do something special. So I went back and I picked some highlight moments, not just from 2013, but over the years as well. Some surprises coming up later on in the show. A much talked about interview. You'll get to hear a small piece of it, and we'll get to hear the some of the staff's reaction to that, as well as talk to some of the people behind the scenes here at KKFI. We have many wonderful volunteers who work very hard to help put this radio station on the air and keep it going. And we're going to let you hear the voice of some of them. Some of them have their own shows. Some of them you only hear in engineering capacities. But we're going to talk to them today and get their comments on all the fun and hard work they put in here on the radio station, in at least in the past year, but for some, for many, many years before that. And we hope you'll enjoy it. I went back into the vaults for this first interview. In fact, it's dark in there. I had to take Phil with me. We went down into the vaults of into the bowels of this radio station, as they say, to search for this particular interview. And we looked. Phil finally found it behind a big stack of Elvis carts. Yes, we played carts on this radio station way back when. But Phil found it. It was my interview with Orson Scott Card. Orson Scott Card is the award-winning science fiction author, and his movie, the movie of his book, Ender's Game, is currently at theaters. Young people, war, and how young people learn to participate in the war by playing a game, and how all of that works. That's the basic topic of Ender's Game. But when I talked with Orson Scott Card, the movie was in pre-production. He had written the book, and his tour was actually to sell his book, Ender's Game. And, of course, he talked about some of the other books he's written as well as some of his own philosophies. But, of course, we touched on the topic of Ender's Game and how it was going to be made into a movie. And I find it ironic that some of the things he said in the interview about the casting and things of that nature actually did come true, fortunately or unfortunately for Mr. Card, in the course of making the movie. And for those of you who have seen the movie and want to compare it to the book and what he says about that, I think you'll find this especially interesting. Then in the second part of the show, some of the people behind the scenes here at KKFI and some surprises, some clips from shows past here on KKFI, I think you'll find very informative as well as amusing. And we'll talk to all the people involved then. So first, let's go to our interview with Orson Scott Card. He was nice enough to drop by the radio station while doing his nationwide book tour and talk with me. I felt very honored. Here's my interview with Orson Scott Card.
Freeze Frame!
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Excessive.
With us this morning is Orson Scott Card. Orson is the New York Times best-selling author and the author of the acclaimed Ender Cycle series, a series of books that has successfully crossed gender lines by creating a sense of wonder that pulls in readers of all ages and from all walks of life. Welcome to Kansas City, Orson, and welcome to KKFI. Tell me your feelings about the way you've been boxed in as a science fiction writer. Surely you think of yourself as more than that.
I've certainly written science fiction, and I'm proud of it and perfectly happy to have my science fiction novels labeled as science fiction. Fortunately, they don't label my non-science fiction novels as science fiction, so I'm okay. I also have a couple of books in a series that I'm calling Women of Genesis, which are the first one is Sarah, the second one is Rebecca, about the wives of Abraham and Isaac, respectively. And another one will be coming soon in that series about Rachel and Leah. And so, you know, obviously those have nothing to do with science fiction, not a spaceship among them, no time travel. But I take the Book of Genesis quite seriously as a historical document and give it the full historical novel treatment for these really remarkable and interesting women. And I've written contemporary novels that have nothing to do with science fiction or the Bible. And so I'm perfectly content that each type of book finds its own readership. But the science fiction audience is one of the best groups of people you could ever write for. They're very accepting, very open. They're constantly looking for new things. That's the whole point of science fiction, is to not read the same thing you've read 1,000 times before. Now, of course, I have to exempt from that statement the readers of the Star Trek novels and the Star Wars novels, because they are, in fact, wanting to read the same thing over and over again, and they succeed in achieving that. But those of us who are writing science fiction, we try not to write the same book twice. They try not to read the same book twice. So I'm proud to be writing for that community, because they're good readers, and they're very accepting of all the weird things that I try in my fiction from time to time. At the same time, I'd like to think that I write science fiction for people who think they hate science fiction. I don't take for granted that you already know all the tropes of the field, and try to make it accessible to readers who have no idea how science fiction even works. Because science fiction does have its own way of being read. The reader not only has to follow the story and follow the characters the way that you normally would in a mainstream novel, but you also have to be developing your idea of how the world works, what the rules of science are, what the situation is, you know, what the differences are between the reality of the novel and the reality in which the reader actually lives. And those things are brought in detail by detail, bit by bit, in the process of telling the story. And if you're not alert to them, you miss them. So you're really following two streams at once. One of them is the world creation stream, and the other one is the story stream. And it's very easy for a reader who's not used to that to lose track. Let's just say that I try to be as helpful as possible to readers who really aren't used to reading that way.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask to explain time travel to me. It seems that different authors create their own rules for what time travel is.
No, but that's the whole point, is there are no rules, because time travel is actually fantasy. It's not possible, and, well, it is possible. We're all traveling into the future at the rate of one day per day. And so time travel one way along the track is at the same pace as everyone else is the norm, and that's what we all do. But you make up your own rules, and each subtle, when I teach writing classes, I point out that every single change changes every story that you could possibly tell within that world. So that if you decide that you can travel into the future but not into the past, that's one kind of time travel. Or vice versa, that you can't go into the future but you can go into the past. And you make up your own little scientific mishmash stuff to explain it all. Or you make up the rule that you can't send your body into the past, but you can send your consciousness into somebody else who's living in the past. Or that you can take pictures of the past, but you can't go. Or that you can listen to the past, but you can't see. Or, you know, whatever rules you want. Then you can tell a story that uses those rules as a framework. The funny thing is that even though we tell stories set in universes that are different from the present reality, we're still talking about the present reality. We just use those changes in order to focus more clearly the issues that we're dealing with. So that when Ursula Le Guin, for example, and Left Hand of Darkness wanted to talk about what is actually real and what is not real about gender roles in society, she said it on a planet where the human race had evolved in a direction that made it so that we had a monthly cycle like estrus in many animals, where you didn't know whether at the end of the cycle you would be male or female. Well, then it's not in anybody's interest to make it so that one sex predominates over the other, because you don't know which side of the fence you're going to be on at any given time of your life. And so everybody has the experience of being male. Everybody has the experience of being female from time to time. And yet when you are within that gender, you're definitely of that gender. And so, you know, very interesting idea that allowed her to speak clearly about issues in our society that were really important to her in the 70s when she wrote that. That's what we do in science fiction and fantasy. Even the writers who don't think they're doing that at all, oh, I'm just writing for escape, that's nonsense. They're writing stories that they care about and believe in, and whether they mean to or not, those stories are going to deal with the issues that they care most about. So we who write science fiction and fantasy are still writing contemporary novels. We're just focusing them differently.
It is said that history repeats itself, and I guess you
it absolutely does. And there's nothing so idiotic that happened in the past that is too dumb to happen again. You know, that people just don't learn from history, especially in America, where it's taught so badly that people have no idea what it even is. And so people are able to tell the most outrageous lies about what went on in the past, and no one catches them in it because nobody studies it. You know, there are a few historians who go, wait, that isn't what happened. Wait. And no one listens. No one cares because we make the past into whatever we need it to be in order to prove our point in the present.
Now, tell me a little bit about the beginnings, the genesis, as it were, of the Ender series. It started out as a short story that you then developed into a full novel?
Yeah, it was the first serious attempt I made to write science fiction, and it attracted quite a bit of attention. It worked better than I expected it to. You know, you always hope that you'll write a story that people will really care about, but when you're starting out, you feel like you'll be lucky if they'll print it and your mother and five other people read it. But it came in second for the Hugo Award when it came out, and that was really very encouraging. But at the same time, I'd already written it, and then I moved on. But then I was going to write another novel called Speaker for the Dead, and the novel really opened up for me when I realized, you know, Ender Wiggin, the character from that first story, should be the main character of this book. But I couldn't get from the end of Ender's Game to the beginning of Speaker for the Dead without going back to the short story and rewriting it as a novel. And that's the only reason it ever came into existence. I was kind of doing it just to set up the other book. Then it turned out to be my most popular book ever. So, maybe it's because I had to relax before I could write it the way it needed to be written. But the truth is, I think that Ender's Game has a particular appeal because it's about human beings who are in isolation, being pressed by other people to do tasks that they really don't want to do. But they go ahead and do their duty and manage to find some nobility and even some freedom in the process of serving the needs of their community. That sounds very abstract, and you'll never hear it in those words in the book. The book is an adventure story, the way that it's presented. But I think that especially with kids who are going to school, a place that most of them don't want to be, and under a lot of pressure to learn to behave in certain ways by society, and a set of pressures to behave in a different kind of way by their peers, that the story of Ender's Game becomes kind of a story about how to find your own way in the midst of unfreedom, to be able to make yourself free. Maybe, but I'm analyzing after the fact. I certainly had no such idea in my mind when I was writing it. When I'm writing a story, all I do is write down the story that I care about and believe in at the time. And if I start finding myself getting bored with my own story, then I realize I've stopped caring. Therefore, something's wrong with the story. Go back and revise it until I do care. And then when I'm all done, I put it out and see if somebody else cares too. And some of my books, the answer is not many people. And some of them, the answer is lots and lots of people. And I'm just glad that I have some that people like, and even the ones that have a smaller audience. I think of my novel, Heart's Hope. It's a very dark and depressing book with a slow beginning. And it puts a lot of readers off. But you know what? I think it's some of my very best writing. And so I'm proud that it's out there. And for those who like it, they really like it. And they're glad that it exists, too. That's really, you know, when we talk about writers who are successful or not successful, I mean, the word successful was used in your intro. And I kind of cringe when I hear that because, you know, I'm successful at some things. But I look back at my older fiction. There are flaws in these books. And you know, I've learned how to write better since I wrote them. Artistically, did I succeed perfectly? Never. I don't think I ever will. I don't know of a writer who ever did. But in terms of financial success, that has nothing to do with whether you're a good writer or not. That has to do with whether you coincidentally happen to have cared about and believed in the same stories that large numbers of people will really care about and believe in. John Grisham is successful not because he's the most brilliant writer who ever lived, but because he tells stories that resonate with a very large number of people. So he makes a lot of money. Same thing with Stephen King. King is a wonderful writer. He would be a wonderful writer even if only, you know, a few hundred people read his work. There'd be less of it because he'd have to have a day job. But it's wonderful when a writer can find a large audience. But it has nothing to do with whether his work is truthful or powerful or successful. That's I think there's a different standard of measurement.
Having said that, now it's moving into a whole new medium now. Motion pictures
right.
Being made from your work. You're working on your first screenplay. What are the adjustments?
I've written about a dozen screenplays. You know, you don't just start from scratch and think you can do it. I was a playwright before I wrote fiction too, so that I've written about 250 audio plays. So, you know, I've done a lot of different stuff and moved from medium to medium. But with screenplays, it's especially hard because you have to please two audiences. You have to write a screenplay that can be read by executives who will then realize that they need to put their money into it. And then the same screenplay is supposed to work as the blueprint for a movie that will be seen, a very different experience, by audiences, and that they'll love it and tell their friends, and they'll all come back and see it 15 times, and it'll make $1 billion. Always the goal of the studio, by the way, even when they pretend that it's just a little small picture and they don't expect it to make much. They really are hoping it'll be the big breakout that you know, earns worldwide millions and millions of dollars. But the two purposes of writing a script are absolutely contradictory, because it's very hard to read a script and know what you're reading. Very, very hard. And I don't know of many executives who can do it. So you have to write a selling script. And then when it's time to, once you've sold it, then you have to go back and change it into a shooting script, which is a very different kind of thing. And a lot of the stuff that you have to include in the selling script, just so that it'll be clear to the readers, you have to remove from the shooting script. Well, so far I've been writing selling scripts for the obvious reason that they weren't yet sold. This is my first experience writing a script that is actually meant to be the script you shoot. We have executives at Warner who are sharp. They get the story. They understand what it needs to be. I don't have to write a selling script now. They understand how the story needs to go. See, I've had a lot of people whose first reaction to Ender's Game was, well, we can make it into a movie, but we have to change the hero from a 9-year-old into a 16-year-old because we got to get that teen audience. And I just cringe, because the whole point of this is that these are innocent children. And there is no such thing as an innocent 16-year-old. He'd have to be really dim-witted to be non-skeptical of what adults tell him. But, you know, a 9-year-old who has lived in a completely sheltered environment where he hasn't had a chance to have experiences outside of what adults have shaped for him is going to be naive enough to believe things that an older kid never would believe. There's no story if Ender is 16 years old. But so many people have not seen it, and I've just, you know, come out of meetings just despairing that it would ever get made. But I think this time we might be able to do it. Wolfgang Petersen is a wonderful director. Working with him and his partner Sam Dickerman, they are wonderful, sharp storytellers. They understand how stories work. And so everything they say adds to my understanding of how the movie needs to go, and they understand everything I'm talking about. It's a great, great experience. There are a lot of good, smart people in Hollywood. You wouldn't know that from some of the films that come out. But they really are. And every now and then, that's why every now and then a really terrific film squeaks through.
Yeah, you talked about in the notes, it talks about the dehumanization of war and the way the children are conditioned through the use of playing a game.
Well, you talk about dehumanization. It's hard to think of an activity more human than war. You don't become dehumanized. You simply dehumanize your enemy so that you can do whatever you want to him. In your mind, you have to, and you have to. You can't go out and start killing somebody if you're sitting there thinking, you know, he has a wife, I wonder how his sister will feel when he never comes home, or when I maim him. That's a terrible thing. You can't possibly conduct war if you're thinking that way about your enemy. You have to be thinking, that's a monster who's going to kill me. If I don't kill him, he's going to kill me, and if he gets past me, he's going to kill everything I love. Sometimes that's even true. You know, Adolf Hitler and what he planned to do, monstrous thing. But there were appeasers before World War II who honestly said, why do we need an army? If an enemy came to our shores, I would simply walk out, greet the enemy, and say, what is it that you want? Let's sit down together and let's see how we can get it for you. And I just think, well, that's swell, but what if the enemy says, well, I want to kill all of your Jews, and if you happen to have any gypsies, we'll kill them too, and then all of your children, we'll use them as slaves and take them off to Germany to work our factories. Hope you don't mind. At that point, you think, oh, maybe we do need to fight, but by then, you know, if you're an appeaser, you don't have an army. You have no way of stopping them. You've already lost. There are times when you have to fight. And so when I write a book like Ender's Game, which is about war, or Shadow Puppets, which has war as one of the central elements involved in it, I really don't write that much military fiction, but in this particular series, military themes are important because that's who the characters are, that's what they do. And it's not that I'm anti-war or pro-war. I regard war as something that humans are going to do because we always have, and I haven't yet seen a new species evolving that doesn't have those same needs, drives, and instincts. It's that you have to, you know, it matters a great deal in fighting a war whether your soldiers really believe they're in the right. And I think that one of the reasons that Hitler lost World War II was because most German soldiers knew that, in fact, it would be a disaster for the world if they won. They did their duty. They were loyal to the fatherland. But it was outrageous to them what was being done in their name. And you just can't fight as well when you don't believe in your own cause. Our trouble as a people is holding together a belief in our cause. You know, America is a great nation and stands for great things. We're a flawed nation. We've made plenty of mistakes. But I hear a lot of rhetoric today that would take our mistakes and act as if they trump what we do that's good. And the truth is, there's a reason why our democratic example has been followed by nation after nation. It's because the people who live in a fairly democratic society, one that still maintains good order but is otherwise democratic and reasonably fair, are happier than people who live in dictatorships or one religion states or one party states where there are no options, and if you offend people, offend the wrong people, you're dead or you can't work again, whatever. It's better. And we're not imposing our will on other people when we go to war against somebody who would destroy what we stand for. We're instead genuinely bringing a benefit to other people. It's not that we should go out and conquer the world so they can be as wonderful and happy and free as we are, but we do have a responsibility to our own people to protect our people, and we do have a responsibility to help those who are trying to live in the way that we have already demonstrated is happier and better than some of the other ways that you can be governed. Now, that's my sermon, you know. But
it was a good one.
I'm not pro-war. War is it's terrible.
It's terrible.
No one wants to go through it. But when it's forced upon you, you do want to make sure that you win.
In a work of fiction in general, not just science fiction, you can create your own reality.
Well, that's right. And I set up the rules so that I can decide who the good guys are.
And make it turn out the way you want to.
That's right.
Do you have any plans beyond this cycle or series?
Oh, I'm writing many different things all along. I have dozens of standalone books that are not part of any series. I have four or five different series going at any given time. They are every kind of science fiction that there is, because believe me, there's more variety inside science fiction than there is outside it. And I have my poems, my plays, my screenplays. You know, I'm busy. The main thing is that it's all writing, because I haven't yet figured out anything else I can do that people will pay me for.
Well, that's interesting. Do you see yourself as a variety, really, more than anything else?
Yeah, you know what I enjoy best, though? Teaching.
What? Teaching?
Yeah, but you just can't make any money at it. And I have employees I'd have to fire if I ever quit and went into teaching full-time.
Can you teach someone to write, or is that something that just has to be
there? There are techniques in writing that you can absolutely teach. You can't give people the fire, and you can't give them the stories to tell and the passion to tell them. But you can give them the skills to be able to tell them more effectively, and that's what I do.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Orson Scott Card, the author of the new book Shadow Puppets and the Ender series in general. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Orson Scott Card from a few years ago talking about his then book, Ender's Game, which is now a motion picture. The picture he talked about writing and the casting, how he preferred a 9-year-old boy rather than older. That movie's now is in the theaters. It's also called Ender's Game, and it's available to be seen. I found the comments so interesting. You know, what he expected to happen, what actually happened. That's always so interesting to follow along as it goes. So as we wind down the year of 2013 here on the Arts Magazine Show, we're going to take a break, and then when we return, we're going to talk to some of the people around here. Some of them have their own shows. Some of them engineer other programs, do things of that nature. We're going to have as many of them that are here right now come on in and give you a chance to meet them and hear some of their remembrances of things that happened over the year. And we went deep into the vaults once again, pulled up a few things for you, which we will play for you when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame!
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Excessive, vulgar, and depraved, The Wolf of Wall Street comes close to celebrating the very corruption it's supposed to be lampooning. Leonardo DiCaprio is fine as a real-life corrupt stockbroker who ran a shady investment firm in the 1990s that became a cash machine. Martin Scorsese's direction is sure-handed as always, but this 3-hour movie is overlong and repetitive. The Wolf of Wall Street is a blowout of debauchery that barely escaped getting slammed with an NC-17 rating. Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, shares the same problem as this year's Steve Jobs biography. It just isn't as dynamic and as important as its subject. It's a respectable and workmanlike film, but it's a routine drama boosted by a strong lead performance by Idris Elba. The film reduces Nelson Mandela's life to a bland series of scenes instead of the gripping and inspirational film it should have been. Ben Stiller's update of James Thurber's classic short story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, starts off beautifully but loses steam in the third act. This well-produced comic fable about the ultimate daydreamer is peppered with many effective moments, but it never quite gets a solid grip on the themes it's trying to promote. Rocky meets the Raging Bull in the Geritol division in Grudge Match, an absurd comedy about two former boxers who set up a match to settle an old score. The bout manages to generate some public interest in spite of the fact that both participants are senior citizens. It's all very silly, but the star power of Sylvester Stallone and Robert De Niro provide a jolt of energy to this predictable enterprise. Stay tuned until the end for the film's funniest scene that involves two other aging boxers. Also opening this week, The Great Beauty is an acclaimed comic drama from Italy about an aging fixture on the Roman club scene who reexamines his extravagant lifestyle. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. There's a new show on KKFI on Wednesday. It's called Art Night. Let's hear a little bit about that.
Wednesday night is Arts Night on KKFI. At 6 p.m., it's Art Speak Radio, followed by the award-winning From Arc to Microchip at 6:30. Then it's live radio theater on L.A. Theater Works from 7 to 9 p.m., followed by chamber music with Dr. Mike. Get your arts on Wednesday night on KKFI.
And thank you very much, Susan. That's Art Night on Wednesday night, Arts Magazine on Monday, often on Mark Manning's show. He has artists on as well as KKFI reaches further out into the arts community for all of that. Oh, Russ Simmons, by the way, who does our Freeze Frame feature every week, and it's not just on this show. It's on various shows throughout the schedule. He also can be seen on Fox 4 News, doing part of the movie reviews over there. I think it's usually early on Friday morning. They do the show live, usually, and then it's played at various times during the rest of the week. So congratulations to Russ on that. He's been doing the Freeze Frame feature here for quite some time now, and we thank him for doing that for us here every week. Well, we're going to have some fun here in the next half hour if all of them will come in the studio. Right now in the studio is Mike Murphy. Now, Mike Murphy is the, is it the operations director?
Chief operator.
Chief operator. Well, we just call him Sir. Mike's originally from the New York area.
Yeah, Sir is short for surly.
That's surly. That sometimes he is, yes. Even with KKFI for how long now?
Many. You know, in various capacities, I guess I first started volunteering in 1995 or 6 or something like that.
Yeah. What's the biggest challenge in doing this show? Me, probably. What are some of the others?
Some of the challenges in KKFI, well, ensuring that we stay on the air is always can be a challenge. Ensuring that because we have such great programs, like for example your program, you know, it's hard to contain it to an hour sometimes, but we have to because you know the Jazz Insider has such a great program.
And
we, you know, so we have to find all that balance and find all that balance. We've got a very eclectic schedule, which is both a blessing and a curse. So it's a blessing because it's, you know, speaks to the rich diversity of KKFI's listening audience, Kansas City and beyond. And but it's a curse because it's not like a single format, so it's hard to, you know, we challenge our listeners more. They have to remember when they're favorite programs are on, and some folks, you know, listen all the time and like to take in that rich diversity. Like, for example, the rest of today, I mean, we've got the Jazz Insider coming up next, then we've got Lady D and Mother's Mix coming up after that from 3 to 6, then it's Eco Radio KC, an environmental program, And tonight, Richard Mabian is going to be looking at the year 2013 in review with from an environmental point of view. And then from there, we go right into Sabor Latino, and which is Betty Norris has quite a following. She gets more snail mail, more letters sent to the station than the rest of the KKFI programmers combined, I think. And so she's got quite a following. And then Fiesta Musical after that. And then it's 2 hours of punk music followed, you know, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. And then KC comes in and does Nocturnal Love, love songs from 2 to 5.
Yeah, he's a romantic guy, isn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, he's yes, he is.
Yes, he really is. But we're speaking with Mike Murphy, the operations director, and I want especially Jen to come in here. She's up at the desk up there. I want her to come in here and help participate in some of this. But before she gets here, we recently started podcasting a lot of our shows, at least some of the talk shows.
That's right.
And a lot of the people, or some of the people, I shouldn't say a lot, but some of the people might not really understand how that works or where they can find it. So if they want to hear a podcast of, say, this show or some of the other talk shows, it's hard to do music shows now because I guess you don't have the rights to do all the music shows. But explain, if you would, some of the podcasting part of it.
Well, so if you go to kkfi.org, and you should be going there anyway because it's, you know, for last year we really upgraded it and really made some strides, and we're continuing to improve on it. So it's a great way to tell what's coming up on KKFI, what's going to be on, for example, Law and Disorder tomorrow. And it's a great, but it's also a great way to, if you missed a show, if you missed last week's Arts Magazine, for example, you can go online and you can, it may be on the homepage if it's recent enough, but you may have to go to the schedule or, you know, and look, and pull it up, and you can listen to the show online. So it's a big help, that way.
Yeah, I went to the on-air guide, and then I went to the particular program, and then, on the episode page, which is a description of the show in general, it'll have upcoming episodes, recent episodes, and the podcast box is down below that, and that's where you can find it if, you wanted to listen to this program played back. We won't actually get it on podcast probably till later in the day, but then you'll be able to listen to all of this all over again, correct?
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, if these profound things coming out of my mouth, one time hearing them wasn't enough.
That's right.
You can hear them again and again and again.
Oh, people always tell me the diversity of the schedule on this show is just is this beyond anything.
That's right.
You really want to hear. Okay, Jen Zaman has joined us as well. She recently returned from a trip to Jamaica.
Yes, I did. Back to 5-degree weather.
This is like a second honeymoon or third honeymoon?
It was our 10th wedding anniversary. So we were there. We left we got back on the 23rd. It was 85 when we left, and we came back, and it was 5.
Well, that's the way it's been the whole time here.
Yes, I know. My mother was keen to text me with photos of the snow from their cul-de-sac and saying, "This is what you've got to come back to. Looking forward to it for your white Christmas." So,
Does the spirit of Bob Marley live in Jamaica?
Yeah. Oh, does it live? It thrives. We really had a great time. I mean, they just. The spirit of the people there were, I mean, they were just all, pretty much as friendly and as laid back and as no problem as you can get. I mean, we really had a great time. And it was just, I just hated leaving the ocean.
Yeah, I guess that phrase, no problem, came up quite a bit.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it really isn't a joke. It seriously isn't a joke. I mean, it was all, no problem. Guy was driving us to the airport, and he's like, no problem. We'll meet you here next time, this same time next week. Yeah, and we're just like, yeah, we wish. Just float us another $5,000.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we had a great time.
Yeah, and she brought back pictures.
Loads of pictures of the beach and of the palm trees and the beautiful blue ocean that I just love so much. So, it was awesome.
Tell us what you're all involved with here. I know you're on the board of directors, for one thing, a newly elected board member.
I am. I am excited. Yeah, that just happened about a month ago, and it has just been a blast. I've been here since February of this past year, and I do a lot of things here. Loads of pretty much anything anybody wants me to do, I'll do. You know, so I'm right now. I'm currently doing a lot of the program episode guides for both syndicated and local programming that we have here at KKFI. I also do I co-engineer the Heartland Labor Forum Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Had to do a little shameless plug there for Judy and company, and along with John Todd, and I will actually be taking over for him for the next month or so while he is on job assignment elsewhere, and so I'll be doing the engineering duties there. And also, I put up podcasts for Freeze Frame, which is on your show, and I do a podcast for Take Two, which is the Russ Simmons and Susan Sanders doing movie reviews, and put those up on the website for your listening pleasure. And good Lord. Just about anything, all and sundry that Mike Warren or Bill need me to do. And I'm also on the programming committee, so we'll see how that goes. And, you know, I just am loving working here and being with all of you people and having loads of laughs with you every Monday, Michael, when you come in. So, yeah, it's been a really great run.
Yeah, was it? You'd undoubtedly heard the station before you actually to work at the station.
Oh, yeah.
How did that perspective change once you got to meet some of us?
You know, actually, not a lot. Not really, because, I mean, I know it's eclectic programming, and it takes a lot of unique personalities to kind of make the station a success. And so I kind of thought, yeah, I think I'd fit in. I think I'd fit in. I'm pretty unique and zany myself. So I thought, yeah, I think I'd be a good fit.
Yeah. Well,
we're all kind of a motley crew here, you know.
Yeah. Sure. Mike Murphy is not at all zany.
Oh, no. He's not in the least bit.
Not in the least.
Well, yeah. Turn up your radios. Now, you spoke of the Heartland Labor Forum with Judy Ansel earlier. And you were actually present in the studio. And it's too bad Phil isn't here. Where is Phil? He's going to be so... Well, he might not be. He might be hiding.
He might be relieved.
He's not here. But Phil Bauer, if your ears are burning, he's one of our tireless volunteers here and just one of the sweetest guys I know. And... yeah, he was there to help us out with the Ed Asner interview.
Yes, the much talked about, except for on the Heartland Labor Forum, as far as I know, never played on the air before.
Yes.
Visit with Ed Asner and with I hope the permission of Judy Ann. So it was her show.
Yeah.
Heartland
mm-hmm.
Labor Forum. Ed Asner made a visit. Now I understand that he was touring with his one man show FDR.
Yep.
And he does several of those characters that he travels with. He's not currently in any network shows, although he's on MeTV all
yeah.
over the place.
Oh, yeah.
That's practically his network now. But he was touring with his one man show, and he's also a major labor activist.
Oh, absolutely.
At one time, wasn't he president of the
Screen Actors Guild, yes.
Yeah. He was president of the Screen Actors Guild for a time and touring with this show. So naturally, Judy asked him to come on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Oh, that is an interview she says she has wanted for eons. She has been just dying to interview him. So we were so excited to have him. He's legendary to have him here in the studio. It was just unprecedented. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. He is Lou Grant. You know, he really is. You know, he's just... you know, he's as curmudgeonly as he is nice. So, you know.
Okay, an example now. Are we ready to play the clip?
We're ready to play the infamous clip with Phil Bauer.
Explain that. Mr. Asner was thirsty.
Yes, he was very thirsty. It was really hot. Now, that day, I mean, it was in the end of June, and it was super duper hot. And, he had just flown in, and he was whisked right from the airport here to the studio, and he was in need of some libations. So he wanted some water, asked for some water, and at the time our water cooler was out of order, and so Phil tried to do his very best to procure him some satiation for his thirsty tongue.
Can I hear
so,
it?
So here it is.
Thank you.
And just for the record, Mr. Asner's response could not be repeated on the air. So
yes, but, we're getting the abridged version.
But you'll get to hear what he had to say about it in the interview.
Yeah, it's been worked on and edited. But here is as much as we can play of our interview, actually Judy Ansel's interview with Ed Asner.
Okay. So welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, Ed Asner.
Where's the mat?
The mat.
The welcome mat.
Oh, it was the cup of water you got.
The rancid water you gave me when I was dying of thirst.
Yeah, but we do good radio.
Well, I hope you do something good because your hospitality is horrible. I asked for a glass of water. I didn't even ask for a glass of water. They gave it to me in a paper cup, and it was hot. It was warm water. And I killed the guy that gave it to me.
Yes, they're carting out his body right now.
And I'm waiting for a bottle to be brought in from outside of sustenance.
Yes, we have sent for one.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, I just landed at the airport, and I saw all of Kansas, Missouri lying below me, before me. And it was green and verdant, as if there had been lots of rain and washing the land. Nobody saved me a cup of water out of it.
And that was it, Asner. And the guy he killed was Phil.
Yeah.
I mean, Phil was a little embarrassed at first, but then when he told me about it, he couldn't wait to tell me.
Oh, my goodness. It was absolutely unprecedented. I mean, I tell you, Phil was just... That literally is the moment that will live in infamy for 2013.
Now, the part that we can't play, Phil, his reaction to Phil.
Oh yes,
bringing
yes.
him the water. Can you clean that up?
Well, I will clean it up. He says, "Who is the moron that brought me this rancid, tepid, hot water?"
Well, actually, when. Phil handed him the water, and he's like, "Thanks, kid." And he takes a sip, and then I'll leave out a lot of it. But the shorthand version is, "Could you make it any hotter than this?"
Yeah.
So henceforth, all of a sudden,
and so
say
then Phil says, "Yes, sir. I'm the moron, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm the moron."
Yeah, I'm the moron.
Which is quote of 2013.
Too bad he's not here.
I know it.
I kept this from him. I didn't tell. But yes, I found that one of the more humorous moments of the
year. God, love it. He's a great guy.
Well, we have some celebrities come through here. I know all of the mayors. Has the current mayor been here?
He's been here.
Mr. Funkhauser, I met several times.
Yeah, he's been here. Of course, Mayor James has been here several times now. Of course, our police chief's also been here a few times.
We've
had quite a bit. Yeah, we've had Bobby Rush here. You know, the Jazz Insider just joined us in the studio. I know Victor Wooten was here not too long ago, and a lot of big names. Of course, we've had Bobby Watson here, and just a lot of big names over the years come through here. The Drifters, like in this past year, I know, like for example, Mike Lytle interviewed Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. That was a pretty big deal, and it's just been a lot of interesting people and with interesting perspectives that are often cut out of the mainstream. Now, you might hear an interview with Ed Asner on some other media outlet, but wouldn't be the content that you got here.
Oh,
we just played the funny part. We just played the funny part, you know. But I mean, he talked a lot about serious issues, and he's an activist of sorts.
Is, yeah.
I've interviewed some people and talked to people who have been interviewed on KKFI who are promoting an album or some project, and they're doing lots of radio, and they often comment on how much different and how nice it is to their experience at this station in particular. At least I'll speak for the jazz programmers, that are, many of which are musicians and very knowledgeable in how much better the experiences compared to maybe a more corporate radio station where they get the sort of stock questions and they're very short interviews. So mm-hmm. I get comments a lot about that, about how it's sort of a special experience here.
And if you're going to,
this is not even the pledge drive. I'm just talking. Yeah.
If you're going to feature something like an artist plays, you know, they're normally like, I suppose you want to play one of the shorter cuts, and they're a lot of times pleasantly surprised. No, we'll play the 8-minute song.
Sure. Oh yeah,
yeah.
I usually love say that. Whatever you want to play.
Yeah,
you
know?
Yeah. Yeah, they're used to like 5-minute interviews on in between numbers on other radio stations. Here they can have as long as you want to give them insider. You want to go by the insider.
Sam is fine for this.
Sam is fine for this.
Yeah. Well, Sam, you also interviewed Max Weinberg, didn't you, a while back?
Yeah, that was a phone interview. But yeah, we talked for a long time.
Max is the drummer for Bruce Springsteen's East band, also for the Conan O'Brien show.
Yeah, yeah. He used to be on the Conan O'Brien show, not anymore.
Oh, okay.
And he was playing at Jardine's old jazz club in town, and was just promoting that show. And
very. He had a big band or something.
Oh
right?
Yeah, he had a big band in this tiny little club, and was talking about touring around with that band. And the jazz geek Roger has interviewed lots of great musicians, and you're just able to get more in depth. Again, I'm not going to give the pledge number here, but I just think it's very cool, and people have commented to me about that and how it's kind of the free form nature of this is nice.
It really is. Now you mentioned Jardine's. Now that is closed completely. Now is it something else?
Jardine's, yeah, Jardine's is closed, but there are several great new jazz clubs in town. There's Take Five Coffee Bar at 151st and Knoll. There's the Green Lady Lounge at 18th and Grand. Brand new place just down the street from here, the Broadway Jazz Club at 36th and Broadway. Obviously the Blue Room. There's lots of places. And a lot of the guests that I have on my show and other shows, particularly local musicians, talk about kind of this very special time period we're in right now in the jazz scene here in Kansas City, really the arts scene in Kansas City. There's lots of great new venues and lots of great musicians. And so as nice as Jardine's was, it's quickly becoming a distant memory.
Yeah. Well, which is too bad. It was a nice place in its time. It had all kinds of problems, I know. Well, what do you think of the emergence of during the film fest every year? They have a music section of that.
The film festival?
Uh-huh.
I don't know that I know much about that I would be willing to. I would probably say something incorrect, so I'm not sure. Yeah.
Which never happens on KKFI,
no,
so we wouldn't want
never.
That to happen.
Never have to make any corrections.
Yeah.
At least not on my show, anyway. So things never come. We're talking with some of the folks that helped make KKFI happen. The operations manager, Mike Murphy, is with us. Jen Zaman, a member of the board, and probably soon to have her own show in the future.
Hopefully.
I'd be willing to bet. Yeah. The unique kind of music. I know when I asked you what kind of music originally you wanted to play on your show, you go, nothing you would like, Michael. Nothing you would
pretty
like.
Pretty much.
So go ahead and talk about it.
Well, it was because I get that asked that question a lot, and no, it is not something that we currently have on KKFI, but it's keeping with the eclectic, view of our station, but genre of music is UK underground dance music of all genres.
Okay.
Everything coming from the UK, from electronic to techno to dubstep to garage to funky to bashment, I mean, grime, all those genres. And people don't know what those are. They may know at some point in the near future, I hope.
Well, the original British invasion in
yes.
the 60s came from Britain. So we may chuckle, but who knows?
We may chuckle. You may laugh now, ha-ha, but...
So my question is, as a programmer, what if you're still doing your show 10 years from now?
Yes.
What are you going to be playing? I mean, would you be?
You would have to evolve with the times,
okay.
And the genres, because you know they said, you know, what was it? 2008 was the year of dubstep, and now 2012 was
so
the year of trap.
So is that all in that kind of vein? Okay.
Yep. Yep. I mean, the genre is probably, I mean, honestly, I mean, to be fair, there's probably at least 12 different genres that are within that, and they are all splinters from other genres in the UK. And but their influence, I mean, has influenced. I mean, there would be no Skrillex without the UK influence in dubstep, because the UK invented it. So I mean, it's, you know, so that's
infotainment here at KKFI.
Infotainment.
Can I mention something about planning for this month? Yeah. I host the Wednesday Morning Buzz. And so this Wednesday is New Year's Day. I expect a lot of folks won't be up to listen that day from 6 to 8 a.m. on New Year's Day. But so I'm going to be playing music to welcome in the new year. But it's also there are five Wednesdays in January. So I'm going to take each Wednesday of the month and look back at a milestone year. So I'm going to start at, this week, looking back 50 years to 1964, and then the following week back to 1974, and then the week after that to 84, 94, and 2004. Look back all those weeks. And so that should be interesting. And the thing that occurs to me about 64, a lot of people, when you mention, well, it's the 50th anniversary of 1964, they're like, really? That was 50 years ago?
Yes.
Well, if that blows your mind, consider this. In another 50 years, it'll be 64.
That's right. It will be again. Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, get in on the ground floor and invest in lava lamps now.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Everything comes back. Yeah. You can tell by just looking around this building that things have come back. Oh, I remember back in the early 90s when Jerry Garcia was still alive and the Grateful Dead did their annual New Year's Eve concert in San Francisco. We carried the broadcast of that live, and in several of those years, I actually hosted it.
Wow.
At the strike of midnight.
That's
here,
wild.
For the Grateful Dead music here. And is there still a Grateful Dead program on the station?
The Grateful Dead Hour is on at 9 p.m. every Friday night, and that's, of course, by the title of the show. It's an hour, but it's followed by a local production called Second Set, hosted by Rick Shale, a local deadhead and musician, and all-around great guy, and he brings his own perspective to that whole scene, which has expanded tremendously. I speak from experience, actually. The Grateful Dead Hour was the Pied Piper that pulled me into KKFI.
Ah.
And I am a deadhead. And so I appreciate what Rick does. You know, it's expanded so much. You know, Jerry Garcia will be dead 19 years this year. Mm-hmm. And there's so much has gone on. The Grateful Dead members have gone into all sorts of different things. But it's also the things they've inspired. All this whole jam band thing all came out of that. Though, you know, the Grateful Dead was a jam band, but I don't think the term existed when they were
a band. I don't
think
so. Yeah. I remember seeing them at then Sandstone back in, I think it was 91.
I was there,
yeah. We talked about that. Yeah. Yeah. Jerry Garcia was on stage. He didn't look too well then, but he was there through the whole time. The thing that got me was they stood the whole time. They didn't speak once, like most of the groups
will say,
hey, Kansas City, blah. Not a word.
Yeah.
They came on, the lights went up, they played, the lights went down, then short intermission, lights came up again. You know, not a word. I guess they didn't feel like they really needed to.
Yeah, exactly. Let the music speak for them.
It was a great experience. It was an unusual experience, but it was really great. Well, that was Mike Murphy, the operations director, if that's the correct title, here at KKFI. Jen Zaman, a member of the board, programming committee, about to have her new underground UK music show. And the Jazz Insider, well, what kind of things are we going to feature? It's great the way you have the background, the stories behind what you're doing on there. I always find that interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I just try to create a show that I would like to listen to. So today I have my obligatory Best of 2013 show, which features a lot of local releases, not because they're local, just because I think they're really good. So that's today's show, a bunch of music released in the past year. So.
Yeah, thanks for that. You're also a musician yourself. Is he allowed to plug? If he can't plug himself on his own show, if I ask him, can he?
It's okay.
Is there anything you want to plug, Sam?
It's okay. People should listen to all the jazz shows. I think that I mean, I think my show is good, and I think Jazz Disciples show on Tuesday is great. Jeff Harshbarger show on Wednesday, KC on Thursday, and the Jazz Geek on Friday. And all those guys know a lot about the music. With the exception of KC, everybody is a busy working jazz musician in Kansas City, which I don't know that everybody knows, and have very large collections and put a lot of time and effort into their shows. And I'm just really proud of the jazz programming here at KKFI. So that's the plug that I will put out there.
Okay, well, thanks all of you for stopping by the second part of the show and learning a little bit about the inside goings-on here at KKFI. When you hear people joking about Mr. Asner's visit in the future, now you know the story. See, that Phil wasn't here to add his input, being the moron that Mr. Asner spoke of. Thanks to all of you for appearing with us. The Jazz
Thank
Insider
you.
Is next. Great jazz information behind all the jazz, as you'll hear him talk about it. Jazz from 1 to 3, the blues with Dorothy from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoke. We'll see you next year, next time.